We have the big parsha of Kisisa. It's really packed with material. But before we return our attention to the parsha, we note that we're in a very special time of the year. It's actually Purim Katan. So for tomorrow and the day after, although it's Adar Aleph, it's already what's called Purim Katan, and we don't say Tachnun, and that already marks it as a special day. I think for some Ashkenazim, not saying Tachnun it doesn't get more festive than that. It's the height of frivolity. But this actually touches on a very interesting question. As we know, in a normal year, we have one Adar. And in a year such as this, Shana Mu'uberes, there's two Adars. Which raises the question, which of the Adars is the added month? And although we might be inclined to intuit that we add on the Adar at the end, we actually see from the Halacha that this is not the case. And this comes out very clearly in a situation of Bar Mitzvah. If someone is born in the month of Adar in a normal year, and then their Bar or Bas Mitzvah is in a Shana Mu'uberes, so in which Adar do they become Bar Mitzvah? And the Halacha is, as stated by the Rama, that it's actually in the second Adar that they become Bar Mitzvah. And that teaches us that the regular Adar is really Adar Beis, so that it is the first Adar which is the added month. And that already is quite a chiddush. We add on before the year is out. So it's the first Adar which is the added month, so that we don't hit the normal Adar until Adar Beis. But this actually touches on a further interesting question. As we know, Purim is also celebrated in the second of Adar. But this matter is discussed, and it's the subject of a debate and a dispute in the Gemara. And there are those opinions, it's a machlokes tanoim in fact, that Purim should be celebrated in Adar Aleph. Now we don't paskin that way. And each side presents an argument for their position. Those who say that Purim should be celebrated in the Adar Aleph, they adduce the principle of Ein Ma'avirin Ala Mitzvahs. One does not forego the opportunity to do a mitzvah, and therefore, as soon as you have Adar Aleph, you have your opportunity to celebrate Purim. Why wait? Why pass up the opportunity? The second opinion, which is the one we paskin like, says no. We have Purim in Adar Beis, the reason being Mismach Geula L'Geula. It is better to join and twin together Geula, the redemption in Purim, with Geula, the redemption in Nisan. So here you have an argument for both Adars. Adar Aleph, not to pass over the opportunity to do a mitzvah. Adar Beis, of joining Geula with Geula. And of course, the problem is, how can there be a machlokas about this? One can only celebrate Purim in Adar. And if, as we have established, that the first Adar is an added month, but it's the second Adar, which is the real Adar, so what room is there for a machlokas? Clearly it must be in the second Adar. That's the only real Adar. What we see from here is that actually, although you can only celebrate Purim once, although some people may ask, why? Why not celebrate twice? But if we assume that you can only celebrate once, that may well be true. But the fact of the matter is that both of these months have the status and the designation of Adar. It's not for nothing that they're called Adar Aleph and Adar Beis. One could have used one's imagination to come up with a name for the 13th month. But the point is, they are both Adars. In terms of the calendar infrastructure, shall we say, both Adars could answer to the description of Adar and could host Purim. It happens to be that one can only celebrate Purim once, but you have two Adars to choose from. In the same way that your average year has 50-odd Shabbases, there can be more than one Shabbos in the year. In the Shanim Uberes, there is more than one Adar in the year. They both answer to the description of Adar. So should we ask the question, will the real Adar please step forward? The answer is, they're both Adar. You just need to then choose which of them is most appropriate to fulfill the mitzvahs of Purim, and there you have your machlokas. Some people say not to pass over the opportunity for a mitzvah, Adar Aleph. Others say that the guiding principle is to join Geula with Geula. But indeed, even in the month, even in the Adar where we don't have Purim, the days are still Purim, even without their mitzvahs. And that's what's reflected by the fact that we do not say Tachnun on the 14th or the 15th, even of Adar Aleph. We could call them non-practicing Purim days, but at heart, it is already Purim. And with that in mind, I would like to wish all of you a happy Purim for tomorrow and the day after. And with this, we shall approach Parshas Kisisa. I wanted to take a look for a few moments at a Rashi in Perek Lamed Aleph. The opening psukim of Perek Lamed Aleph, the first 10 or 11 psukim, are a review, as often is the case, another listing of the elements within the Mishkan. And you have them all listed out from Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Yud Aleph. And then Pasuk Yud Beis Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Lemor, and let us see Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ve'ata daber al b'nei Yisrael Lemor, speak to b'nei Yisrael and say, Ach es shabsosai tishmeru, which we will translate as, however, you shall keep my Shabbases. And this is one of the big places in the Torah where it speaks about Shabbos. In two or three verses' time, we'll have Vashomru v'nei Yisrael as a Shabbos, which we say on Shabbos morning. But let's look at this phrase closely and carefully, Ach es Shabsos ha'tishmeru, and laying particular attention on the word Ach. What is the connotation of this word Ach, however? Rashi comments, Af al pi shetihiyu redufim uzrizim, even though you are active and involved in the malacha, that is to say, the malacha of building the Mishkan, Shabbos al tidache mipaneha. Shabbos is not set aside in favor of building the Mishkan. That is to say, one doesn't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. What's that got to do with the word ach? Rashi cites, and it's a statement of Chazal in the Yerushalmi in Brachos, Kol achin virakin miutim. All instances of ach and rak in the Torah are miutim. They are limiting words. They are excluding words. And what Rashi means to say is, the meaning of the word ach here is that even though you have the enterprise of building the Mishkan, ach, that is limited and restricted by Shabbos, because it does not override the Shabbos. That is Rashi's comment. We should know that the Ramban, as we get down to business here, the Ramban is very upset by this comment of Rashi. How could he possibly be upset? All Rashi did is explain the Pasuk. You've got the Mishkan, you've got Shabbos, and Ach, Shabbos limits the Mishkan. Says Ramban, if you look at the source of Rashi's words, that Achin and Rakim are limiting expressions, you will see that they never come to limit in the matter that was previously mentioned. They always come to limit in the matter that's being presently introduced, presently discussed. Here, we've been talking about the Mishkan, and we're moving into Shabbos. If you have the word ach, the way it's meant to be used is not to limit what you just spoke about, as Rashi seems to be saying, that Shabbos is limiting the Mishkan. Rather, it reflects a limitation or a restriction, an exclusion within Shabbos itself. And indeed, says Ramban, if you look, for example, in the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, in the 8th Perek, you will see that they derive from this word, Ach es Shabsos haTishmeru. It's one of the sources for the idea that Pikuach Nefesh is Doche Shabbos, that danger to life overrides the Shabbos. In other words, says Ramban, what do you see from here? You see that Chazal look at the word Ach, stated in the context of Shabbos, as imposing a limitation within Shabbos. Namely, you don't keep Shabbos in the face of Pikuach Nefesh. Shabbos gets diminished. The matter that's being discussed gets diminished. And that's what should have happened here. So, in brief, he has an issue with Rashi explaining the Ach of Shabbos as limiting the previous idea, building the Mishkan, because the Ach of Shabbos should limit Shabbos itself. Rather, says Ramban, the situation is as follows. If you want to know whether you build the Mishkan on Shabbos, the answer is, of course, no, but not from the word Ach. That's very simply from the juxtaposition of the topics. You have the Mishkan, and the very fact that it's followed by Shabbos itself limits the Mishkan. But if you want to know what to make of the word Ach within Shabbos, it's a limitation within Shabbos of not overriding or being set aside by Pikuach Nefesh. So this is Ramban's very serious charge against Rashi. You invoke a concept from Chazal, you got to use it the way Chazal intended, to limit within the matter being discussed. Which leads us, of course, to ponder, what would Rashi say? How does Rashi see all of this? I would like to, if I may, make matters worse, just for a moment. Because we will see, from another comment of Rashi, that he actually agrees with Ramban. He concurs with Ramban's position that Ach limits within the matter being discussed, not the previous matter. Where do we see this? Let's take a look at another Ach in the Torah. In Parshas Emor, Vayikra Perek Kaf Gimel, where all the Yomim Tovim are being presented, as we start with Pesach, Omer, and Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, let's zone in on the Pasuk of Yom Kippur. And what does it say? The Pasuk begins, Ach be'asor lachodesh hashvi'i. Yom Kippur is introduced with the word Ach. Okay, naturally, we're curious. What are we going to make of this? Rashi comments, Kol achim v'rakim mi'utim, invoking the idea again, Ach and Rak, limit. And then says Rashi, what does this mean? It means mechaperhu lashavim. Yom Kippur affects kapara for people who do tshuva. Ve'enu mechaper le'enam shavim. But it does not affect kapara for people that don't do tshuva. And this is the well-known position of the Chachamim. Yom Kippur is a great gift, but you've got to use it together with tshuva. So what do we see from this comment of Rashi in the Ach of Yom Kippur? We see that even he concurs that the word Ach limits within the topic being discussed. Yom Kippur is the topic being discussed, and the Ach limits Yom Kippur. It doesn't work across the board. It doesn't work in an unqualified manner. Rather, you've got to do tshuva. It's a limitation within Yom Kippur. And so we see from the second example that Rashi is also on board with Ach limiting within the idea being discussed. What then is the way forward for Rashi? And I think that the key here, as always, is to remind ourselves, what is Rashi's goal in his commentary on the Torah? And we don't need to guess. Rashi himself has informed us. Bereishis Perigimel, Pasuk Ches, Va'ani lo bosi ela lepshuto shel mikra. My job is to explain the pshat. V'la'agoda ha'miyasheves es ha'pshat. And if necessary, says Rashi, I will invoke Agoda, I will invoke the words of Chazal from the world of Drash to resolve the pshat. In other words, if we could put that into one sentence, Rashi's methodology in his commentary on the Torah is, wherever possible, pshat. Where necessary, Drash. And taking that on board and bearing that in mind, let us consider, there is no question that if we were to ask, what is the simple meaning of the word ach? What is the pshat meaning of the word ach? The word ach means however, or except. There is no question that on a pshat level, the word ach is coming to limit that which was stated before. We've been talking about topic A, however, limiting that because topic B can impose itself. So on a pshat level, the word ach clearly faces backwards to limit that which was mentioned before. When we see in the world of Chazal that they expound the word ach as limiting within the topic being discussed now, that is a tool of drash. That is a drash exposition. And as we know, wherever possible, Rashi will take the pshat approach. Where necessary, he'll take the drash approach. And now comes the million-dollar question. When is it possible? And when is it not possible? When is it an option to take the pshat approach? And when does one have no choice but to take the drash approach? I think the answer is very simple. If the two topics being bridged by the word ach have a parity with each other, can be compared with each other, that the second is coming to limit the first, then Rashi will take that approach, because that's the pshat approach. But if they have no such relationship, so that approach is not possible, and where it's not possible, Rashi will take the drash approach. Let's put names to faces so that we're absolutely clear what we mean. In our two examples, in the case in this week's parsha, is there a relationship where the second can limit the first? There is. Because what was discussed first is the Mishkan, 10 psukim of Mishkan, and then comes Shabbos, and you have a good, however, scenario. Because build the Mishkan, however, you have to keep Shabbos. And because the Mishkan and Shabbos lend themselves to a pshat approach, where Shabbos says, however, looking backwards at the Mishkan, limiting the Mishkan, that's the approach that Rashi takes. It's in the second case, in the case of Yom Kippur, that it's not possible. Because what's mentioned before Yom Kippur? Rosh Hashanah. And now go and apply however between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You can't. They're both heading in the same direction. It's not meaningful to say, firstly, you have to keep Rosh Hashanah. However, you must keep Yom Kippur. That's not a however. They're heading in the same direction. And because there is no pshat way that the Ach of Yom Kippur can limit Rosh Hashanah, Rashi has no choice but to say that the Ach of Yom Kippur is limiting within Yom Kippur itself. And although that's drash, when pshat is not an option, Rashi will take the drash option. So that is the difference, if we can summarize, because it's a subtle idea, but it's a world of difference. with the Mishkan and Shabbos, you can say, build the Mishkan, however, it doesn't supersede Shabbos. And the Ach is the Pshat, to mean however. But between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you can't say, keep Rosh Hashanah, however, keep Yom Kippur. And therefore, with Pshat not an option, Rashi takes the Drash approach. I think that is very clearly what is guiding Rashi in these two situations. And that is the answer to the Ramban's question. Ramban says, look in the Gemara. You'll see that Ach es Shabsos HaTishmeru is limiting Shabbos. It's Pikuach Nefesh. Says Rashi, I know. Rashi's also learned the Gemara. But Rashi's job on the Chumash is not to learn Gemara. It's to explain the Pshat in the Chumash. And that can be done here. Not so in the case of Yom Kippur. And I believe there is a PS here, which, if it's correct, is a truly wonderful thing. In both the cases that we've mentioned, and there's more achs in the Torah, that's we'll call that homework. But of the two cases that we've mentioned, Mishkan and Shabbos, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Rashi mentions in both of those instances, he quotes Chazal, the adage, or the principle, kol achim v'rakim miutim heim. Ach and rak comes to diminish. With one difference. In our parsha, Mishkan and Shabbos, he quotes it at the end of his comment. In Parshas Emor, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he quotes it at the beginning of his comment. What is the difference between whether Rashi quotes it at the beginning or at the end? I think the difference is, or the difference lies in how Rashi is using that principle. In our parsha, he's using the idea that Ach comes to limit, which comes from Chazal, but he's not using it in the way that Chazal do. Because Chazal in the world of Drash always limit what's being discussed now, but Rashi's not using it that way. He's using the Ach of Shabbos to limit the Mishkan that came before. And therefore, he cites the principle of Chazal, but he leaves it till the end. In other words, he first gives free rein to his explanation, and then says, I got this from Chazal. It's not an accurate application of what Chazal are saying, because their drash and this is pshat, but it does come from there. But he only mentions that at the end, which is not the case in the second example in Parshas Emor. With Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because as we've said, Rashi himself takes recourse to Drash, he is absolutely using this principle 100% the way Chazal themselves would use it. And that is why he quotes the principle at the beginning. He starts by saying, "Kol achim v'rakim mi'utim," because what will follow is a complete application of a Drash approach to what Ach is, to limit within Yom Kippur itself. And so we see the more attention that we pay to Rashi, mindful as much as we can of Rashi's goal, Pshat where possible, Drash where necessary, I think that opens up, and it's such a short word, Ach, but we see how carefully Rashi didn't just give a blanket approach to the Achs in the Torah. Each one is assessed and analyzed and considered for its syntax in terms of what came before it and what came after. Having done a bit of work in Rashi, I'd just like to finish this section with a wonderful comment of the Chasam Sofer. If we return to Ramban, and as we know, Chasam Sofer has a great affinity with the Ramban. Ramban told us that there's two messages coming from the Pasuk. The very mention of Shabbos after Mishkan tells us that you do not build the Mishkan on Shabbos. And second, the word Ach within Shabbos teaches us that Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbos. And what does this teach us? The Pasuk reads, Ach es Shabsos haTishmeru, ki os hi beini uveinechem nadoraseichem. It's a sign between me and you for all generations. Ladas, to know, ki ani Hashem mikadishchem, to know that I am Hashem who sanctifies you. How does this pasuk teach us that Hashem sanctifies us? Says Chasam Sofer, as far as we're concerned, the holiest entity that we can envisage is the Mishkan, with all the vessels and all everything that goes on there. We'd only imagine that the building of the Mishkan would override everything else. And we see that that's not true, because the building of the Mishkan stops when you come to Shabbos. And that teaches us that in this regard, there's something higher than the sanctity of the Mishkan. It's called the sanctity of Shabbos. So now we've reorientated ourselves. Now we know that the holiest entity is not the Mishkan, it's Shabbos. And then we discover that there is something more sanctified still than Shabbos. And that is Ach Shabsosai Tishmeru. In the case of Bikuach Nefesh, Shabbos is set aside, which means that even Shabbos is not the highest and holiest value. What is the highest and holiest value? It's the soul of a Jewish person. And if you make that equation and you see how Shabbos is topped, the Mishkan is topped by Shabbos, but Shabbos itself is topped by Pikuach Nefesh of the Jewish people, what is the takeaway from that? Says the Pasuk, Lada'as ki ani Hashem mekadeshchem. Well, that with that you will know that I am Hashem who sanctifies you. If you take the messages of Shabbos overrides Mishkan, but Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbos, you will emerge with a very clear message. Lada'as ki ani Hashem mekadeshchem. Very beautiful words from the Chasam Sofer. Well, we've held off from the Chet HaEgel as long as possible, but it really does dominate the Parsha and change our history and the history of the world as we know it. And therefore, let us now turn our attention to the Chet HaEgel. And I'd like to begin by making a reference to a comment of Rashi, actually in Parshas Chukas. It's a well-known comment of Rashi. He cites his teacher, Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, with regards to the Parah Aduma. And Rashi cites that the Parah Aduma comes as an atonement for the Chet HaEgel. The well-known mashal of the child who soils himself in the palace of the king, and they say, let the mother come and clean up the mess of the son. Nowadays, of course, the father would come also, but this is back in the day. And let the mother come and clean up the mess of the child. Tavo ha'em v'tinaket tzoras ha'ben. Who's the mother? Who's the child? The mother is the parah aduma, is the cow. And the child is the egel, and the egel is a baby cow. So the egel is the mess, and the parah aduma cleans up the mess. And that teaches us that the parah aduma comes to atone for the Chet HaEgel. There's just one problem. As everyone knows, parah aduma is in a very specific category, which is called chok. Chok means we do not understand what the mitzvah is about. But this puts us in a bit of an uncomfortable situation, because officially the Torah is telling us that we do not know what the parah aduma is coming for, what it's all about. Rashi enters and says, let me tell you what it's all about. We're not sure what to do. If Rashi's read the Pasuk, so he should know that we can't explain it. But Rashi proceeds to explain it. So it's a strange situation. Even Shlomo HaMelech in Koheles states, Amarti Echkama, I thought that I would be wise. V'hi rechoka mimeni, but it is too distant from me. And the Medrash explains that this refers to Parah Aduma. Amarti Echkama, says Shlomo HaMelech, I thought I could understand all the mitzvahs of the Torah. And he started at the beginning, and he was 6'12 for 6'12, and left the best for last, Parah Aduma. I thought that I would attain ultimate wisdom and understand the Parah Aduma, v'hi rechoka mimeni, but I can't work it out. I can't understand it. I don't know what it's all about, says Shlomo HaMelech. Which is a shame. Should have looked in Rashi. Rashi's got it all worked out. It's a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. So what are we to make of this? According to the Gemara, the Chet HaEgel returned us to a certain situation. What do we mean by that? The Gemara says that at the time of the original sin of the Eitz Hadas, Zuhama, impurity, entered the world. However, the Gemara continues, there was a moment in time where we recovered from that impurity, when we stood at Har Sinai. B'sha'a she'amdu avoseinu al Har Sinai, when we stood at Har Sinai, paska zuhamasam, the impurity ceased. But when we made the egel, it came back. What we see from this Gemara is that the egel did not introduce us to a new situation. It actually brought back a predating situation, a pre-existing situation, which pertained after the Chet Eitz Hadas. We recovered at Matan Torah, but then we had a relapse at the time of the Chet HaEgel. And what is this all about? What does the Chet HaEgel have to do with the Chet Eitz Hadas? I mean, they're both sins, but what do they have in common? The Beis Halevi explains, if we wish to get a sense, and of course these are very deep ideas and mystifying episodes, but if we wish to get a working understanding of what went wrong at the time of the Egel, we need to consider the following. The Egel was not made as a replacement for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Egel was made as a replacement for Moshe. Until now, Moshe has been a conduit between Hashem and the Jewish people. As far as the people are concerned, he's gone and he's not coming back. And if that's true, they need to replace or find a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu. And they're looking for some means through which to connect with Hashem. Until now it was Moshe, now they need an alternative. There's just one problem, and it's a glaring problem. The alternative to Moshe, the replacement for Moshe, is standing right in front of them. It's Aaron. Surely the most intuitive next choice, Moshe's gone, okay, and even if that's true, you need someone else. That's Aaron. Aaron was a leader of the Jewish people before Moshe. He stepped aside. But if Moshe's gone, Aaron is the natural choice. And what did the people do? Instead of going to Aaron and saying to him, Moshe has gone, apparently. What should we do now? Instead of approaching him with that question, they approached Aaron, but with an instruction, saying, Moshe has gone, and now this is what you need to do now. This is what we want you to do now, to make an egel for us. There was some type of reversal in the relationship. They should have approached Aaron to receive instruction from him, but instead they approached him and gave instructions to him. What lies behind this? At the heart of the matter, and the Kuzari says similarly, but the Beis Halevi really amplifies and elaborates, at the heart of the matter is something within the human being, and the Jewish people were not immune to this, which compels the person to chart his own path, if only he can. It's born of the conviction that the person knows what's best for him, regardless of what anyone else may say. As long as necessary, he'll follow instructions. But if he only gets an opening, he'll begin to issue instructions and chart his course. And that was the beginning of the downward spiral of the Egel. The Jewish people sought to reinitiate their relationship with Hashem, but at their initiative, at their instigation, and in a sense on their terms, and telling Aaron to make an egel. This compulsion is not new. It is as old as the human condition. And where do we find it? With the very first sin. that if the Chet HaEgel is baffling, the Chet Eitz Hadas is absolutely confounding. Because Kohelas tells us that Adam was created yashar. He only wants to do the right thing. Upright. He only wants to follow Hashem. So let us ask the question, how then is it possible to sin? There can only be one answer. And that is if Adam only wants to do the right thing. The only way to understand that he does the wrong thing is for the right reasons. In other words, guided by an overarching desire to connect with Hashem, he disobeys Hashem's instructions in the interim. What is known as Aveira Lishma, a sin for the sake of heaven. The tree from which they ate is called the Eitz Hadas Tovara, the tree of knowing between good and evil. And they're not allowed to eat from that tree. Ask the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, I'm not sure why eating from that tree is such a bad thing. If it brings you knowledge of good and evil, that's knowledge that you should want. How else can you avoid evil? How else can you know what's good if you don't know the difference between good and evil? It's a very basic question. So how is knowledge that is essential for people to choose good and avoid evil, why is that barred from them? That's the tree that you can't eat from. Says the Rambam, people's choices before that sin were not guided by good and evil. They were guided by concerns of truth and falsehood. Meaning, before the sin of Eitz Hadas, disobeying Hashem's will, it wasn't wrong. It was simply false. It was clear that it could bring no benefit. So no one would ever sin. And now Adam begins to reason. To choose the right path, where the wrong path is patently false, is a very low level, relatively low level accomplishment. Wouldn't it be better to partake of the fruit of the Eitz Hadas? To begin to see the right and wrong choices, not in terms of true and false, but in terms of good and bad. As if to say, maybe sin could bring me benefit. It's morally wrong, but it could be of benefit. To enter into that vision and still choose the right thing would be a much greater accomplishment and would be a greater glory to Hashem. And therefore, what Adam seeks to do is to temporarily disobey Hashem on this one occasion in order to obey him more on every subsequent occasion. The ends justify the means. That's called an Aveira Lishma. Now it seems flawed from the outset, because if you wish to follow Hashem's will, he's told you he doesn't want you to eat from the Eitz Hadas. But something is pushing Adam and Chava. Although Hashem has given me the program, something within me feels I can come up with a better program, better even than Hashem. And if that sounds ridiculous, that's human nature. This is what lies at the heart of many sins, and certainly the original sin. Human intellect is limited, but a human being's appraisal of his intellect is very often unlimited. And that gap is very large. In fact, says the Beis Halevi, when Hashem confronts Adam with the famous words, "Hamin ha'etz asher tzivisicha levilti achal mimena achalta," you ate from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from. Why does Hashem describe it in that way? The tree that I commanded you not to eat from. Just say, did you eat from the Eitz Hadas? Says Beis Halevi, a very profound idea. When Hashem describes the tree as the one I commanded you not to eat from, he's not just identifying the tree, he's identifying the source of Adam's sin. You probably can't even explain what compelled you to disobey me. I'll help you out, says Hashem. I told you not to eat from that tree. That's what impelled you to eat from it. because that triggered an impulse where if Hashem says no, maybe I can do yes, because maybe my ideas might even be better. And that, on day one of human existence, already cast us into the darkness which that the world is still in. And yet, the Gemara says the impurity that entered the world at the time of the Eitz Hadas, it left when we stood at Har Sinai. What happened at Har Sinai? Har Sinai is the location of our finest hour, represented by the words Naaseh V'Nishma. What is the understanding of Naaseh V'Nishma? If you've never thought about it, and of course we have, but had we never thought about it, Naaseh V'Nishma is impossible. It's backwards and it's impossible. Naaseh means we'll perform mitzvahs. Nishma means we'll hear the mitzvahs. So go back to stage one. Naaseh, we'll perform the mitzvahs. Which ones? We don't know, because you haven't heard any yet. So you have to hear the mitzvahs in order to do them. Which means the very famous Naaseh V'Nishma sounds like it should be rather Nishma V'Naaseh, we'll hear and we will do. What is the meaning of Naaseh V'Nishma? The meaning, says the Beis HaLevi, is that Naaseh means we're committed to do. We say yes. We are prepared to do. Even before hearing. The answer is yes. And then we'll hear what's involved. But how can you say yes even before hearing what's involved? It can only be because you subscribe to the idea and you're reconnecting with the idea that I don't need to hear in order to say yes. The very fact that Hashem is commanding me is already grounds for yes. I need to hear to know the details. In other words, it is a return to implicitly trust in the idea that the axiom that Hashem's goals and plans for me are the best that I could hope for myself. If I have that, then the answer is yes. I need to hear, but so I'll hear. But Naaseh first, and then Nishma. And that is why the Gemara says that when we stood at Har Sinai, the impurity of the Eitz Hadas left us. If we can begin to see how Naaseh V'Nishma is the full recovery from the Eitz Hadas. Eitz Hadas says, I think I could do better than Hashem's plans for me. Naaseh V'Nishma means, it's clear to me, I could do no better. The answer is yes. But then, of course, we come back to the Chet HaEgel. The point of the Chet HaEgel, where the Gemara says that the impurity returned. So you have Eitz Hadas brings impurity, Har Sinai recovery, and then Chet HaEgel relapse. The relapse of the Chet HaEgel, in terms of our discussion, it's because the Chet HaEgel is a rehash of the original sin of the Eitz Hadas. As surely as the Eitz Hadas was born of the compulsion for Adam to chart his own path, so too in their own way it was for the Jewish people. And that is why the effects of the first sin was to bring death into the world. Aside from being a punishment, which of course it is, it's a natural consequence of detaching from Hashem, the source of life. If you're connected to the source of life, you have unlimited life. But if you detach, so then your days might be numbered. And that is why the Gemara says that when we stood at Har Sinai, we stood to be free from the angel of death, because we're back again connected with Hashem. And that is why the Pasuk says in Tehillim, it's in the Shir Shayom for Tuesdays, so it will be tomorrow morning. The Pasuk states, Ani amarti Elohim atem. Hashem says to the Jewish people, I said Elohim atem. And it's important here that the word Elohim is not pronounced Elohim. Elohim is when we're referring to Hashem. So out of respect, we say Elohim. But the word Elohim can refer to people. Judges are called Elohim. Angels are called Elohim. So that's worthwhile keeping an eye on. Sometimes people think they're being frumer and they're actually making a terrible mistake. When Hashem says, Ani amarti Elohim atem, I thought that my plan was that you would be like Elohim, that you would be like angels, connected to ultimate life. And that is the possibility of Har Sinai. But how does the next pasuk read? Achein, which is reminiscent of an ach. However, indeed, ka adam temusun, but in the end you die like Adam. And that, says the Medrash, is a reference to the Chet HaEgel. Death once again came back into the world because we detached from Hashem. But the deeper understanding, when the pasuk says, Achein ka adam temusun, you'll die like Adam, it's not just giving an example of someone who died once. Ka adam temusun means that you'll die for the same reason that he did, because you made the same mistake that he did and sought to detach yourself, with death being the result. So it's truly fascinating to see the historical sweep, literally from day one, as it then moved upwards at Har Sinai, down again at the Chet HaEgel. All of this brings us back to where we started. The Rashi who tells us that the Parah Aduma comes to rectify the Chet HaEgel. And we had a question. How can you say that? How can you propose to suggest us an explanation for Parah Aduma? Parah Aduma is a chok. We don't know why we do it. How then can you say that it comes as an atonement for the Chet HaEgel? Says Beis Halevi, what does it mean? Parah Aduma is a chok. We don't know what it's all about. And yet, we do it anyway. Why? Because it says so in the Torah. Says Rashi, that's an atonement for the Chet HaEgel. That's a tikkun for the Chet HaEgel. If the Egel began by us saying, it's got to be the way we understand, otherwise we're not interested. And it's our plans and we don't even want to hear Aaron's plans. If that was where the mistake was made, the rectification is to come back and to fulfill a mitzvah like Parah Aduma, where we don't have a hope of understanding. But it says so in the Torah. And if we have that connection again, that's the tikkun for the Chet HaEgel. Indeed, what do we know about the effects of the Parah Aduma? As much as we don't understand what it's all about, we know what it does. It purifies from Tumas Meis. It purifies from the impurity of Misa, and now we can understand that a little bit as well. In coming to fulfill a mitzvah that we don't understand, but because Hashem said that's what we need to do, we're reconnecting again, and at least the tumah that's currently associated with death is then expiated through that. But the truth is, as the Beis Halevi continues, the implications of this idea go far beyond Parah Aduma. Because the truth is that all mitzvahs contain within them an element of Parah Aduma. All mitzvahs are mingled with each other. All mitzvahs are interconnected with each other. If the Torah is a body, then every part of the body, as much as it's distinct, but it has the genetic code of every other part of the body. And so too with mitzvahs. And that means that there is an element of Parah Aduma within every mitzvah. That pasuk in Koheles that we quoted, where Shlomo says, Amarti Yachkama, I thought that I would understand Parah Aduma, Vihi Rechoka Mimeni, but it's beyond me. The next words in the pasuk are, Rechok Mashehaya. That which was is distant. What does that mean? What is that which was? Says the Beis Halevi. Shlomo has gone through 612 mitzvahs and understood them to his satisfaction. But when he now encounters a mitzvah which is entirely beyond his comprehension, he now realizes that he never fully understood any of the mitzvahs. Because every mitzvah has an element of Parah Aduma in it. Every mitzvah has what you could call a Parah Aduma embassy, where it's Parah Aduma rules, even within the mitzvah. And what might this look like? Well, even the mitzvahs, whose reasoning is eminently understandable to us, but the details, the exact shape of the mitzvah, the parameter of the mitzvah, why this is part and this is not part, why it stops here, no further, but no nearer, that's a chok. And the word chok actually means a boundary. The boundary of the mitzvah we can never understand. And that's why if you didn't have a mitzvah, you could debate from today till tomorrow how far this value goes. And therefore, being faithful to the details of the mitzvahs is responding to the Parah Aduma within each of the mitzvahs. And the reason why this is so significant is because the Medrash says that the final redemption will come in the merit of the Parah Aduma. So when you hear a statement like that, so all eyes turn to a Parah Aduma, if you can find one. And as we know, you know, every once in a while, a cow is born and is completely red and it becomes the subject of great scrutiny. People don't stop staring at it for the first 18 months just to make sure that it stays completely red. I think that's enough to give you gray hairs by itself, being the subject of such scrutiny. But even in the absence of a Parah Aduma, we can understand that we meet Parah Aduma in every mitzvah that we encounter. Because to be faithful to the mitzvah, to the parameters, and to the specifications, even though they are chukim within the mitzvah, that is its own form of fulfillment of Parah Aduma. And certainly to reconnect with Hashem as the giver of the mitzvahs, that itself has to be a decisive step towards the geula. So I think what this discussion does is it takes the Chet HaEgel, it extracts it from a historical event that happened so many years ago and really presents it as an ongoing concern that can relate to each and every person. And all of a sudden, there's a lot to learn in our own experience from the Parah Aduma and what it represents. I'd just like to conclude, really just have a few moments left, with a well-known statement of Chazal on a Pasuk at the end of the Parsha, Perek Lamed Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Zayin. And it's a big discussion, but at least to reference it and to emerge with a very meaningful point. So Perek Lamed Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Zayin reads, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Ksav lecha es hadvarim ha'eleh. We have the second Luchos in our Parsha. Hashem says, write these words on the Luchos, Ki al pi hadvarim ha'ele karati itcha bris ve'es Yisrael. Because it is based on these words, I have cut my covenant with you and the Jewish people. Al pi hadvarim ha'ele. Says Rabbi Yochanan in the Talmud in Maseches Gittin on Daf Samach, the bris between Hashem and the Jewish people is Torah Shebal Peh. Lo koras HaKadosh Baruch Hu bris im Yisrael. Hashem only sealed a covenant with the Jewish people. Ela al Torah Shebal Peh. And how does he derive it from the verse? Because the verse says, Ki al pi hadvarim ha'ele. Al pi is a reference to Torah Shebal Peh. But what does this mean? Why is the bris, our covenant with Hashem, why is it based on Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, and not the written Torah? Says the Maharal in the Sefer Tiferes Yisrael, the idea of a bris is not just an agreement. It's not just an arrangement. We translate bris as covenant, whatever that means, but it's not just an agreement. The word bris means a connection. The function of a bris is to connect the two sides. And Hashem's bris with the Jewish people is to connect him and the Jewish people through the Torah. And yet, says Maharal, if you wish to be connected with Hashem through following the mitzvahs as they are in the written Torah, you'll find it impossible. Because they're stated in such a general way, And there's so much that is not known, and so much which is vague or generally stated. So you don't yet absorb what Hashem wants from you. Not fully, not down to the details. And therefore the Torah remains distant, and Hashem also remains distant in that way. Rather, it's through Torah Shebaal Peh, which gives you all the details and gives you all the explanations. And now when you have all of that, you can absorb it, and it's closer to you. And if the Torah is closer to you, then the giver of the Torah is closer to you. And it is that closeness which is reflected and referred to as the bris. And that is why the Gemara says Hashem sealed his bris with Bnei Yisrael through Torah Shebaal Peh. And still the question remains, the follow-up question. If what's missing is the details, why do we need an oral Torah for the details? Why not just write the details in the written Torah? And then you'll have everything you need. And you can have your bris connection. You can have your covenant connection. If what's missing is the details, so write them down. And let the bris be on Torah Shebichtav. Many Rishonim give a rather straightforward answer. There is no end to details, as we know. And therefore, you can never really write something that will have all the details. Rather, you give the tools to expound the halacha in all those detailed situations. It could be. But it could be something else. If the point of a bris is to establish a connection, you only ever really establish a connection with something that you invest in. With something that you put yourself out for, that you put effort into. Then you're connected to the enterprise. If all the details were written in the Torah, what would we do? What would our role be? To read. And read we would. But we'd be purely receiving with no investment. We would have all the information and none of the connection. And that is why the details of the mitzvahs are left to Torah Shebaal Peh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, we need to get connected. And if we're going to get connected, you need to invest. You need to think about it. You need to work it out. You need to develop it. You need to expound it and propound it. And by the time you're finished, that investment will give you the connection that is the stuff of which a bris is made. And that is why so much of Torah was left for Torah Shebaal Peh, and the Jewish people have been applying themselves ever since, and in so doing, connecting themselves intimately with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is the bris of Torah Shebaal Peh. And these are sentiments well worth contemplating and reminding ourselves of. As we're in the parshas of Matan Torah, Purim is not too far away, also a time of Torah Shebaal Peh. But the two, of course, go together. Al pi advarim ha'ele, at the end of the day, the oral Torah is there to explain the written Torah. That synergy is important for us. And the more we invest in all of these areas of Torah, the more we will establish a connection between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, known as the bris of Torah. All the very best. Have a wonderful evening and a great week ahead.